Thank you very much, Simon. So since I'm presumably sort of the longest term participant in this program, I really would like to thank those people who made all the work. I don't have the nice pictures as yesterday from Peter. Anyway, so I think it's a wonderful workshop, and I'm really extremely grateful that you made all these efforts for organizing it and, you know, putting all the work into sort of the application and actually making it very successful. So thank you very much. Okay, so now the topic of the talk looks at first sight sort of slightly sort of orthogonal to the kind of things which we heard before. But this will be sort of like a transient phenomenon. I mean, you will see in 5 minutes that it's really connected sort of to two-dimensional field theories and disordered systems and, well, anyway. So let me first sort of tell you a little bit about the physics, which sort of remind you and well known, but might be useful so that, you know, you see that I'm actually talking about a rather concrete problem. So that's the issue of equilibrium crystal shapes. They have some material. I mean, typically in experiments they would have lead, and you cool it down. And I want to do everything at fixed volume, so the number of atoms is fixed. And as you cool it down, let's say below the melting temperature, I mean, then of course the system crystallizes and forms a droplet, and the shape of this droplet will be governed by the surface tension. So the surface tension would depend on the orientation, so it's a function on the unit sphere, and it's sort of well known that under this fixed volume constraint, what you actually see as the shape is simply the Legendre transform of the surface tension. So nature does for you automatically the Legendre transform. Okay? So the crucial sort of thermodynamic input is the surface tension. And as you sort of, I mean, close to the melting, it's sort of completely isotropic. I mean, the shape of your crystal would be basically a sphere. And as you cool down, you sort of see more and more of the atomistic structure. And then there's this specific temperature, which is called the Waffning temperature, which, in fact, there are many Waffning temperatures, but I mean, sort of usually you think just of one Waffning temperature, where this surface tension sort of develops cusps. And if you go to the Legendre transform, this means that you see facets for your equilibrium crystal shape. Okay? So here is what you have. So if the temperature is above the Waffling temperature, the sigma will be smooth. You have just a rounded shape. Of course, it's no longer really a sphere, but it's sort of somewhat deformed, but it's still sort of a smooth three-dimensional shape. And then below the Waffling, there will be a certain direction, special directions. And of course, I mean, this is why you have several Waffling temperatures. I mean, you know, when the cusp actually appears, it does depend on the orientation anyway. So there will be cusps, and this gives facets. Okay? Now, in the systems which you're going to study, one can, you know, once you have such a facet, you can make an expansion close to the facet. So typically, I mean, for this example of lead, I mean, it will be the 1-1-1 direction. And so if I write the surface tension in terms of polar coordinates, then here you sort of see the cusp. So that's just a sort of a linear behavior. Absolute value of U. U is sort of the tilt or the orientation, and theta is the polar angle. All these things are anisotropic, therefore these coefficients sort of will depend on the orientation as I expand relative to the 1-1-1 direction. And the crucial fact about the system which we're going to study is the next order correction will be of order U cubed, which is sort of typically correct if the interaction is short range, or maybe also for some more long range elastic type interactions. Anyway, so the systems which we are studying are characterized that they have, first of all, this linear behavior, and then there will be sort of the next order term will be cubic in the sort of in the Weidel coordinate in this polar plot. Okay.
Just now, question.
Yes.
Assuming here that the bulk is infinite, that is, if the bulk is finite, it will be rounded.
No. Well, okay. I mean, so we are assuming here fixed volume. And so, you know, it will be a non-homogeneous system because it's fixed volume. And then, of course, I mean, we want to let the volume very large. And I mean, the real cusp, of course, also, you know, as always, appears only in the infinite volume limit.
That's right. But in practice, of course, the volume of the whatever.
Yeah. Okay. I show you a picture. You will see what it is in practice. Yes. So the important information is that once you do the Legendre transform, this cubic power translates into an r to the 3 half power for the shape of the crystal. So here you have the facet, which is flat, and then there will be the bounded piece, and the way how these two things are joined goes with the powers we have. That's something which was derived many years ago by Prokofsky and Talapov, and it's this exponent which will sort of play the root, will be sort of very crucial in the rest what I have to say. So let me first show you sort of what this looks like in experiments. I mean, these are sort of, you know, I mean, the Waffening is of something old. I mean, it was presumably done in the 50s. And I mean, experimentalists actually tried a lot to really see this. I mean, this is not so easy. But by now they have very good techniques. And so this is typically, I mean, I took this from a review article of Bonzel. I mean, that's the Jülich group who worked for years and years on such kind of things. And so this is sort of roughly the state of the art, what people can do. So this is the way how you set up the experiment. There must be a support crystal, otherwise, I mean, it would be floating. And this is sort of the crystallite which you're actually interested in. So this is, tungsten. This is rubidium. I mean, it's always the same system with this. This is rubidium, and this is lead. Okay? And so here you see, cool it down, and you can see that you have sort of here the famous 111 facet, and then there are other facets which are appearing in particular sort of orientations, and the interest will be here sort of in the most prominent phase, and then you see sort of a magnification. So here is the crystal steps. I mean, this is the facet, and this out here is sort of the rounded piece. Okay, so that's the way how you should think about it experimentally. Yes?
Just to follow up on that question, actually what you're doing is looking at the finite size corrections of the free energy, right?
No, I really look at the surface tension in the infinite volume limit.
But isn't this really finite? Well,
I mean, okay, it's a question of definition, but I mean, if I think in terms of bulk free energy, of course, it would be a finite size correction. Yeah, you're totally right, yeah.
If you look at the magnification, you have a flat face, and then you have the next step. You mean that this, what is the height?
Oh, these are really monoatomic steps. I mean, they're just, yeah. I mean, here I show you the next picture where this is sort of enlarged a little bit, and, you know, where they very proudly claim that they confirm this Prokofsky-Talapov feature. So here you see the steps. I mean, that's, of course, I mean, this is scanning panel microscopes. So these are the steps. I mean, but they are supposed to be really monatomic. And this is also what they say here. I mean, these are the steps, and this is sort of the Prokofsky-Talapov law. It tells you also sort of, you know, roughly with what kind of precisions they can see by now sort of this we have exponent.
The following description was a continued description.
No, sure. I mean,
and now at the level of one step, you see.
Yeah, well, okay. This is, yeah, no, no, sure, sure. Yeah, yeah. We'll see more of this. I mean, but this is sort of, you know, when, you know, they just take sort of the particular sort of step profile, and then they fit it with the power law, and it seems to be work very well, right? I mean, so, but these are really monatomic steps, yeah. Okay, so now, once you look at these pictures, of course, it's nice to have this equilibrium shape, but would be also even nicer if you would know something about the fluctuations around the equilibrium shape. Okay, so that's the next topic. And it's clear that I have to sort of distinguish three regions. I have to distinguish between the facet, which is this one over here, and then there's what I call the rounded piece. I mean, this is where you have a smooth equilibrium shape, and then, of course, there will be the borderline between the two. Okay, and so let me first tell you sort of the basic information. I mean, if you do the rounded part, then what you do is you take your surface free energy, you just do a Taylor expansion up to the quadratic term, and then you see that you get an action which is sort of a Gaussian free field. Of course, with the coefficient, which is surface dependent, which depends on orientation, so it's not completely isotropic. I mean, you know, depending where I am, I mean, the variance of this Gaussian free field will be slightly different, but, you know, it is a Gaussian free field. And so so in the bounded part, I mean, you have sort of Gaussian, sort of long-range type of elastic type of fluctuations, which, since the surface is two-dimensional, will be then sort of give you logarithmic height fluctuations. So they're actually quite minute. I mean, it's the deviations away from the equilibrium shape is very small. Yeah. Now then you have the facet. Well, in the facet, you might have sort of small, sort of like a dilute gas of defects. I mean, once in a while there might be an extra atom or maybe no atom. This has a finite correlation length, so it's sort of really like a dilute gas, and we have exponentially decaying correlations. If you look at the picture, like this one, and you look for defects, you're not going to see any, right? I mean, so it just tells you that, I mean, this is at 380 Kelvin, so presumably the idea of modeling this by something which is essentially zero temperature is not such a bad idea. Yeah. All right, so we have the two cases which are easy to deal with. And then, of course, the question that's sort of the topic of my talk is what about the facet edge? So you have this line here, which, of course, plays a very special role because it's sort of confined. So here's the facet edge. It's confined sort of, you know, by all these other steps, but then sort of in principle it can fluctuate into the facet. But I mean, they are sort of confined because it's sort of, you know, would have too little entropy. And so the question is, I mean, you know, what are the fluctuations of this facet edge? Yeah. And let me sort of go directly to the punchline. The claim, and I will sort of explain you sort of the evidence. I mean, the claim is that if I'm below the Waffning temperature, then the assertion is that the transfer is fluctuations. So these are the fluctuations measured in this direction. R on the scale R to the 1/3. R is the size of the facet. And so since we're talking about asymptotia, I mean, so, you know, the volume goes to infinity, the size of the facet, I mean, it scales self-similar. The size of the facet also goes to infinity. And for large R, I mean, the claim is that it goes like R to the 1/3. In fact, I will also explain, you know, more precisely, not just sort of the single point function, but also sort of multi-point functions. And the crucial thing is, and sort of connects to what we have been discussing during the workshop, is that this this line is actually in the 1D KPC universality class. Okay, I come to this remark in a second. Let me first sort of explain you maybe a little bit this word here, and then I come back to the remark which I wanted to make here. Okay, so that's the claim. So let me first explain this sentence a little bit more concretely. And the claim is the following. So I'm looking at this Kadar-Parisi-Sang equation in one dimension. So here it is. I mean, that's sort of the evolution equation for the height with space-time white noise. And I want to look at this with very special initial conditions. Namely, I want to start with initial parabola. So this is sort of like, I mean, sort of it's open downwards. I mean, so it's minus x squared on some scale L naught, and then you can easily work out what the solution is if I ignore the noise. I mean, that's quite simple. And of course, there's some displacement. Well, there's a displacement, which is this A of t, which is sort of not so important, but the most important point is that this parabola, so to speak, opens linearly in t. I mean, so that's just the solution of this equation. And if I make the plot, I mean, then if I just do the deterministic plot at some later time, and then you will see essentially such kind of parabola. Now you add the noise, then of course I cannot solve it any longer, but I mean the idea is that, you know, the noise, I mean, will not change so you will not change the shape so dramatically. I mean, you will pick up small fluctuations sort of around the deterministic shape. And then, you know, we have developed a theory which tells us, you know, what is the precise statistics of these fluctuations. So this is sort of the description in terms of the KPC equation. And the claim which I'm trying to support here is that it's in complete analogy to the facet edge. And the analogy goes in a very simple way. Here's my facet edge. I mean, what is the growth time t corresponds to the size of the facet. Now, of course, this is sort of rounded here, but I'm just looking at one single portion. Maybe this one. Eventually, you know, when I study fluctuation, I will just sort of, you know, take out a little piece here for my facet edge. So the fact that it's actually sort of actually a circle-like, it's not important for what I'm trying to discuss. And then, of course, you know, at some given R, you will have a certain surface profile, which in this approximation I can represent as a function relative to this coordinate frame to the x-axis. Okay, and at least picture-wise, I hope to convince you that these two things sort of look similar. And now the assertion is that when I look at large T in the Kadar-Parisi-Sang equation, and when I look at large I in terms of my facet, then I will see the same statistics as a function of x. I mean, of course, it's true only in the scaling limit of a very sort of usual universality kind of thing. Okay? So this is the thing which I wanted to explain to you.
Sorry, I've got a question.
Yes.
I'm not clear why you're using a growth process to describe this rather than some equilibrium statistical mechanics.
I will do so. I mean, the point is that what I'm saying is you just do plain equilibrium statistical mechanics, nothing else, okay? But the result of the analysis will be that what I will see in the scaling limit is identical to the object which I get from the growth process, okay? So, no, I mean, you're totally right. I mean, you know, I'm doing just, I mean, as you will see for the rest of the talk, I will just do, except for the very end, I will just do plain, you know, straightforward Boltzmann ways. I mean, there's no, I mean, I just want to say that there is this analogy and that's sort of what I find interesting in this problem, okay? Okay, so let's see. So then there's one thing which I sort of usually emphasize again here is that you see if you look on this side of the picture, it's very meaningful to talk about correlations in T. I can ask what is the height at particular time T, and then at some later time I can ask myself how are these things correlated. If I look at the right side of the picture, that was exactly your remark. Of course, I mean it doesn't make very much sense, right? I mean I take the Boltzmann distribution at volume V1, and then I take it at volume V2. I mean, it's just two different distributions. There's no meaningfully fully defined sort of correlations between the two. So I will be always on this side of the picture. But I want to say that the mapping which I propose here is sort of a partial mapping. You know, it certain properties are sort of reflected, but not all properties of the growth process can be refound can be revealed on the level of this equilibrium statistical mechanic problem. Okay? And so this is sort of why I wanted to put this sort of, I mean, just put this here in order to remember. So I go one slide back. You know, I put here this six vertex and KPC line. I mean, this is sort of, I mean, work which was done in the early 90s, where people realized that when you do the two-dimensional six-vertex model, and when you look at the transfer matrix in the six-vertex model, then at very special points in parameter space, it looks like exactly like a growth problem in the KPC universality class. And that was helpful because, you know, for the six-vertex model, people had developed sort of in particular beta type of techniques, and so one could use this kind of beta techniques, beta ansatz type of techniques in order to analyze the growth problem, right? I mean, so, but this is just an identity as we are used to. It's just a moment. I mean, this is just really the same thing. It's the transfer matrix of the six vertex model, which is identical to the one, you know, I'm just sort of singling out what I mean by space and time, and I have special initial conditions, etc., but it's just really an identity. This is not what I'm talking about. I mean, this is what I want to emphasize. I mean, I'm talking about the other analogy, which is only a partial analogy, but which gives much, much sort of more detailed information. Now, Pierre.
It's
not the stationary measure. It's the time dependent. You see, what I'm doing is I insist on special initial conditions. I insist on initial conditions which are parabolic. I don't want, it's not stationary. It corresponds, if you think in the directed polymer, it corresponds to end to end. It corresponds to end to end, I mean, you know, point to point directed polymer. Not stationary.
Sorry, in the crystal, the facet size, that does not scale up with the overall size of the crystal?
Yeah.
So, but that doesn't play any role like the
point. No, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. It's this R, you see. I mean, if I want to, wrong slide. If I want to go closer to the scaling regime physically, what I have to do, and that's what they have to do in the experiment, I mean, they have to make the volume larger, and therefore the size of the crystal facet larger. Of course, experimentally there are some limits, and I come to this. But the point is that the scaling parameter here is really the volume. Okay. All right. So now I'm back sort of to the regular order. Now let me tell you what I want to do. I mean, I'm really first on this side of the transparency. So we do equilibrium statistical mechanics. The question is what kind of model, right? I mean, now, of course, you could sort of invent sort of particular model which you know, once you understood everything, might be actually quite sensible. Anyway, the way we proceeded was sort of somewhat differently. I mean, we picked out one particular model which we are rather confident is sort of close to the physics, and then for this we produce an exact solution. And from there on, we sort of continue to see how general actually the predictions are. So what I would like to explain to you in the first part is the analysis of a very specific equilibrium statistical mechanics model, which we call the 3D icing corner at zero temperature. Okay, and then for this, I'll sort of explain you how the facet edge fluctuations are actually sort of analyzed, and a little bit about the result. And then in the sort of third part of the talk, I would like to sort of come back to related models, which are sort of tilings of special domains. And in this other type of tiling problems, which usually are, go under the name of Aztec diamond, you can see sort of the connection to the Crow's problem much more clearly. I mean, this is sort of something which is called a shuffling algorithm, and there you see this connection sort of on a microscopic level, so to speak, not only in terms of, you know, some lines and some pictures. Okay, so this is what I have to say. Okay, so let me go to the 3D icing corner.
Yes. Another Fields medalist of this year, Andre Okonkwo.
Yes, he will come up. I mean, yes, right, so he will come up. Yes, yes. Yeah. Absolutely, he will come up. Yes. Okay, so here let me explain you the model. So I just want to do plain icing model at zero temperature in the lattice gas language. And so the problem, what I have to do is I have to minimize the energy under fixed volume. And let me first do a few two-dimensional plots so you can more easily understand what the description is, and then I immediately switch to three dimensions. So here in two dimensions, suppose I give you n squared atoms, you want to minimize the energy, then of course you get a perfect square. But now what I want to do is I sort of want to offer the system sort of slightly less than n squared. So n squared was this one. Now I want to sort of remove m atoms if you want so. Okay, and then of course I cannot sort of take them out of the middle, I mean, it costs too much energy. So what you're going to see is sort of basically shape something of that type. And I mean, this is sort of like sort of a decreasing function in this coordinate system, right? I mean, so it's only those configurations which are admitted. Now, of course, if I start removing too many m's, I mean, then these corners will interact, and then the picture sort of looks a little bit more complicated. But what I want to do is I sort of want to make a model where I ignore this interaction, which is not very relevant for our purpose, and just want to look at one single corner over here. And this is why we call it corner model, okay? And now it's easy. Sort of give you already the hint how it's defined. I mean, you just look at height functions. So I mean, height function sort of means now, I mean, you know, a function which gives you this height over here, and this height function is simply decreasing. So here is the model. So the height function is positive. It's defined over the one-dimensional integer lattice. It has to be decreasing, and the volume is fixed. Okay, and then you ask yourself, what happens when this volume constraint goes to infinity? For those people who are going to teach a graduate course in statistical mechanics in the next term, I advise this as a very nice exercise. I mean, it's instructive. You can compute exactly what the shape is. You can also compute. It's not very difficult, but it requires a little bit of thinking. Yes.
You really need that your function is the question. You cannot have.
No, you cannot have. I mean, this is sort of because I'm working at zero temperature, and you know, anything which sort of would sort of, you know, go up here, I mean, would cost you so much energy that it would be forbidden. So it's really, I mean, this is sort of comes from the zero temperature constraint. All right, so here we have it. Okay, now it's clear that we can do the same thing in three dimensions. So again, I mean, it's the corner model, so I'm fixing my attention to this particular corner, let's say. And then now I have a height function which is defined over the positive quadrant. It has to be decreasing in both coordinates. I mean, the height is integer because I'm still working on this on the lattice. I mean, all these things are integers. And of course, I have the volume constraint. I mean, the volume constraint means that the volume under this function is fixed. Okay. And the sort of group theory, I guess one has sort of this Young diagrams. I mean, it's just sort of isomorphic to three-dimensional Young diagrams. And the weight which I'm taking is sort of taken from statistical mechanics. Since we're working at zero temperature, there are still many configurations, but they all have the same energy. So according to statistical mechanics, they should simply have equal weight. And so I'm working at a purely entropic model. There's no energy, so to speak. I'm just counting.
But can I ask
yes?
Why that's physically reasonable? Maybe if you could show the top bit of the transparency. I mean, I'd have thought the interactions when you had corners close to each other, or to put it another way, when you showed your original pictures on the previous transparency, I'd have thought the optimum energetic arrangement might have been to take all the M atoms out of one row
Well, then, no, yeah, sure, you're totally right. But you see, this is what I would say. I mean, I want to make M sufficiently small. If you make M large, so then, of course, it is, I mean, just to take off a complete row. I mean, that's absolutely correct.
Yeah,
but if I make it small...
But for M in that range, why don't you take off part of a row and just have a single step?
Okay, so, I mean, this is why I put, very carefully put this condition. If I'm under this condition, I mean, you just sort of make the drawing, then you realize that you know, this is exactly the kind of configuration. Here I've taken, I mean, the picture is misleading because I've taken out too many atoms already. So in this picture, you're totally right. I mean, the better way would be to do it like this.
But that's not what I'm saying. I'd have thought when you have corners that it would cost more than when you have straight edges.
Well, not according to this energy. I agree that, you know, maybe one can make sort of more realistic models where also you would take some corner energies into account. I mean,
what I mean. Why don't you have some second neighbor?
Yeah, sure, sure. No. Yeah, you can certainly complicate the model. I mean, there's no question about that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I just sort of, you know, I cannot do much more, so I have to stick to this simple one, okay. But no, you're totally right. I mean, this is sort of, okay, anyway, so this will be part of the scaling theory, sort of to argue that you know, I mean, the model is simplified, but it's not oversimplified. Okay, so let me show you what a configuration looks like. So here, I guess it's always sort of a question of how you visualize these things. I mean, you know, I'm now sort of looking from the bulk of the crystal sort of onto this thing, and so these are the ones, I mean, behind this are, so to speak, the atoms which I've taken out. Okay, I don't know whether this can be seen. It always takes a little, I have to look myself. Anyway, so what you should see here, this height function. I mean, so here's a particular height. The next height, it's increasing in this direction, then it's decreasing, and here sort of height zero. I mean, so this is the way how you should view this picture. It's just a drawing of the height function. But of course, if you sort of forget about this, then you can see, and this is what will be the last part of the talk, that this is connected to tilings, right? I mean, you know, if you sort of forget the third dimension, I mean, then it means that I have sort of three different type of rhombi's. I mean, here the red, the green, and the blue ones, and I have to tile my domain, but I have a somewhat sort of, in terms of tiling, a somewhat strange boundary condition. You know, I want to fix the volume, and the volume is not so easily expressed. It's not such a natural quantity in terms of the tiling. But anyway, I mean, so this is what they look like. Now you want to sort of convince that you know, you're not sort of, you're looking at the model which is reasonably realistic. So let's do a computer simulation, which is sort of a little bit larger scale. I mean, this is now, I guess we have sort of taken out sort of like 500,000 atoms, and this is what you see on the large scale. Okay? So now again, we have a different visualization. Now I mean, you should think of this as my cube, and I'm sort of looking from the top, and this is sort of one of the corners on which I concentrate myself. Okay? And you see that the result of the computer simulation is very convincing. You see, indeed, three facets. I mean, of course, they are perfect.
This simulates sizing model indeed in 3D? Or?
No, this simulates the model which I explained to you. It simulates directly, it simulates height functions with equal weight. I mean, so it simulates not the full Ising model. This takes infinite amount of time. It simulates this model. Okay? You just do a standard Monte Carlo simulation.
Just
microconical under fixed volume constraint, that's right. Yeah. And so what you see is this one. So in particular, what is important to me here is that in contrast to the two-dimensional case, in three dimensions, you see that I really get these three facets. I mean, so one, two, and three. Of course, they have no defects, I mean, just by construction. You see the bounded piece, which are supposed to have this massless free field fluctuations, and here you see the facet edge, and if you look up here, you can see more precisely what the facet edge is here. It's really monoatomic, and it's the statistics of this facet edge which we would like to understand. Okay?
Could you say, is the Ising energy related in any way to the Okunkov weight?
Well, you mean the Okunkov weight on
different versions?
Yeah, that's the trouble. I mean, so.
Well, there's something where it goes down the diagonal of the partition.
Yes.
Or, across the diagonal.
Yes.
And I think it's just. There's some parameter Q, and then you raise that to the power.
No. Here you just take, I mean, you take any three-dimensional Young diagram which satisfies the volume constraint, and then you would take equal weight. That's what statistical mechanics tells you. Maybe we can discuss this in more detail. Maybe there's okay. So let me just stick to this at the moment, and then maybe there's still some connection. I'm coming to Kunkhof in a second. So let's see. So where are we? Okay. So this sort of tells us that somehow we are looking at the model which seems to be not so far away from physical reality, right? Okay. Now we want to analyze this line here. And the way how I want to do that is what everybody would do. I mean, you first go from microcanonical to canonical. I mean, you know, at that stage, I can easily do it. I didn't want to do it in the original Ising model. That's sort of not such a good idea. But once I have looked just at one corner, I mean, I can do it. So here I put the volume in the exponential. So the lambda parameter will be now the one which will go to zero and which sort of governs the average volume. It goes like this. The height typically goes like lambda to the minus one, and so the lambda you should think of in the following as, if you go to the continuum limit, you should think of this really as the lattice spacing, right? I mean, so lambda will be the lattice spacing, Lessing spacing goes to zero, and in this limit I will sort of, under this scaling, I will see a non-trivial shape. Okay? So this is exactly what you do in the computer experiment. If I would make the system larger, I would do exactly the same plot, you would see the same thing, except for the fact that the lattice spacing is now sort of only one half of it, right? I mean, okay. So now first question is, what about the macroscopic shape? Now the surface tension for this model was computed a long time ago by Wu and by Blöte and Hillhorst. So that's basically the tiling problem, if you want. So what they looked at, and then of course in principle we know already what the macroscopic shape is. I mean, this is sort of this Lechendre transform. But it's, you know, mathematically at least it still requires a proof, because we are looking now, you know, with this volume constraint, and after all, you know, I mean, this is sort of conjecture that the two things are related the way they should be related. But anyway, that's okay. I mean, that's result by Cerf and Kenyon. I mean, they prove that for this very model, in the limit, you do obtain indeed the macroscopic shape as computed from the surface tension determined by Blöte and Hillhorst, right? And they also tell you a little bit, you know, what kind of fluctuations you have. In particular, what is very important is that you can verify for this model the Prokhorovsky-Talapov law. So if I look at the macroscopic, I don't display any formulas because they don't look so nice. But if you look more precisely and see how this piece sort of goes into the bounded piece, then it really goes like R to the 3 halves in the continuum. Okay, now the next question is, are the fluctuations, so this is... work. I mean, Kenyon did things, not exactly this model, I mean, sort of related model anyway. So I mean, they have sort of a variety of models for which one can show that if you are in the smooth, in the rounded part, I mean, then you get indeed a Gaussian free field. And as I said, it's modulated. I mean, you know, you have to sort of, I mean, you take your rounded piece, you take a little region out of this piece, which is still sort of, which is small compared to the macroscopic size, but which is very large compared to the lattice. I mean, to the microscopic atomic units, and then you show that in the scaling limit, indeed, it goes to a Gaussian free field. And of course, if I look at some other one, it will be still a Gaussian free field, but with a different sort of strength or different surface tension, right? Okay, so far so good. Okay, so now the question is, how are we going about to analyze the facet edge and the first part was actually observed already by Okunkov and Reshetykin, but sort of in a very different formulation. And so let me just sort of give me my way of thinking about it. And so now I want to explain you how we analyze the facet edge. Now this leads to sort of this kind of determinantal line ensembles. I mean, this was something which Okunkov and Reshetykin somehow observed already.
How were they motivated to look at these questions?
Well, you know, they were coming from this, I mean, I guess the Young diagrams, and you know, they're sort of a mathematical community, which, I mean, you know, has a actually quite long tradition, and there are all kind of other things connected to this, which I just sort of cannot explain here. But the main point is, I mean, just to make clear what the difference is between what they did and what we did. I mean, they also observed the fact that at fixed finite volume, it has this determinantal structure, but they never thought about actually doing the asymptotic analysis, which really gives you the continuum limit. I mean, this is sort of our contribution. And of course, we were helped because we knew already, you know, you will see the formulas in a second, but we knew already what the result should be. I mean, so this helps, because the asymptotic analysis is a little bit complicated. If you know already what you want to get, it makes life a little bit easier. And it's long and complicated analysis. I mean, I'm not going into this. I just sort of want to give you sort of what is the starting point where you can actually do some asymptotic analysis. Okay, so here comes sort of a very simple observation. I mean, you want to go to gradient lines, and then you want to make a twist by pi over 4. So let me show this in picture what this means. So here, I guess I'm showing you again this height function. So this is the height function, all right? And so here you have the height. I mean, here you have the two coordinates of the quadrant. And now you introduce what I call the gradient lines. I mean, you just sort of walk along this way. So this is just sort of height 0. Now you go up. Stay constant, you go up, go up, go up, and then you go down again. Okay, then you take the next one, which is this one. You go up, you go down, this one, go up and down, etc. Now here there's nothing to go anymore because it's flat anyhow already, right? Now this doesn't really look like a nice line ensemble because you have this funny corner here. Now let's just remove it, so tilt it up by 90 degrees, and then you will get sort of lines which are sort of running parallel to your x-axis. And let me call, because I mean this is sort of what will come out in a second, let me call this now rather sort of like a fermionic time axis. And the picture which you get after this simple transformation is this is what's sort of the first gradient line, that's the second gradient line, that's the third one. Eventually they are completely straight because you're already in the facet, and so as I go to minus infinity, you know, it will just be just line after line, and nothing very interesting is happening. Okay. See that to the left things are going up, to the right things are going down, and you also see that by construction these time lines can never touch. Okay. Okay. So this is what I mean by going to this, going to the line ensemble. So these are the gradient lines and this twist. Okay. And now of course you have to work out what is the weight according to whatever the Boltzmann weight is. I mean, so you have to, I mean, geometrically the lines...
Are they strictly decreasing or weakly decreasing?
Weakly, I guess. I mean, you know, they can, you know, let's see.
In the three-dimensional plot.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sure. I mean, I can have flat pieces which are very long, right? And then, so they're weakly decreasing, I guess, in your language, yeah. Okay, so let's see, what did I want to say? Okay, so I mentioned, so now I want to transform the weight, I mean, so the volume in terms of the coordinates of these lines. And so typically what you have are sort of, I mean, these are all living on the lattice. I mean, I guess it's sort of shifted by half a unit anyway. So these are the coordinates where I have a jump, and the S's are the points, are the height of the jump, right? And they are living on the lattice, and also the S's are living on the lattice. Here the S has, I mean, they are sort of in this, anyway, so this is, these are the coordinates, and this kind of coordinate system I can use for every line. Right? And then if you sort of think a little bit, I mean, it's actually not so hard to convince yourself that the volume is sort of a sum over all lines, because I have infinitely many, and then for each line I just have to sort of compute this shaded area, which is this simple product. Okay, so in terms of these coordinates, the volume is a rather simple function. And I emphasized already the gradient lines do not intersect. And for t less than 0, so down here, they have to increase. And so you have up steps only, so they go up, up, up. And here they go down, down, down. But the height is unconstrained. I mean, it can be whatever, you know, 2,000 or so. I mean, there's no...
numbers of up and down steps? Hmm? K and N are numbers of up and down steps.
K and N are the number of up and down steps. That's right. Yeah.
What's the twist here? Sorry.
Hmm?
What is the twist?
What?
It says twist by pi over 4.
Oh, this was this point. I mean, if I. It's unfolding. Yeah. Okay. Very good. It's unfolding. Yes. Okay. Okay. So it's just going from. It's going from this picture, which are the gradient lines, to the unfolding, which gives you this line ensemble, okay? All right, so now let's see, I have to get this straight here. So where are we? Line ensemble. Okay. Now we want to... either you just continue with the computation, but there's also some combinatorial theory of Gessle and VNO, which tells you that if you have non-intersecting lines on a directed graph with no loops, then they are sort of determinantal formulas, okay? And you see that in our case, I mean, this is fortunately correct. I mean, so this is the time direction, and here I'm just sort of going forward. So I imagine that time minus infinity is on the left and time plus infinity is on the right. And then you have sort of directed for positive, for negative t, your bonds are directed upwards, and for positive t, they're directed downwards. See, I don't have a mixture. If I would have suddenly sort of, you know, I mean, if there would be also a possibility to go down in the same sort of, at the same coordinate, a J coordinate, I mean, then of course I would be no longer directed, and then I'm really in trouble. But anyway, so I do fall under this category. And now you look at the Boltzmann weight, and then you see that sort of essentially all what I have to do is I have to weight these upward things with a weight factor, which is Q. But the Q depends on the J coordinate. It's an inhomogeneous system. I mean, you know, as I'm going very far out, I mean, you know, I have very few steps. If I go in the middle, I mean, I will have lots of steps. So the Q will be less than one. But very far to plus or minus infinity will be essentially zero. And if I'm very close to the middle, it will be very close to one. Okay, so let me write this down sort of a little bit more carefully. So I want to do just a one-step transfer matrix. So maybe I didn't say this. I mean, so the way I want to analyze this problem is by introducing a transfer matrix. Sorry, I wanted to mention this. I mean, so I'm introducing a transfer matrix which transfer from this way all the way through. This is why I call it T, all the way to this side, right? So the transfer matrix would go from T to T plus one. Okay. And I'm just writing to you, I'm writing down for you sort of the transfer matrix for one step. Okay. And okay, so now I can just read it off from this picture. So you see it's exponential in the height. I mean, this is I minus j, and it's one-sided because I have the zero sitting here. So on one side I have only up jumps, on the other side I have only down jumps. Okay. Now once you have this transfer matrix, I mean, that's sort of what Gesell VNO guarantees for you automatically, but you can also do the computation. You can rewrite this in terms of exponential of quadratic form in fermion operator. So that's just a standard fermion operator, and you work out what the matrix is, and the matrix is basically this exponential, and then you pick up this x factor of 1 over I minus j. Okay? I emphasize that this is not symmetric, obviously. Okay. All right, now you have done it for one step, and now you see it's not so hard. I mean, now I have to sort of, so this is for the up step. If I want to do the down step, I mean, I just have to take the adjoint of this, so that's very easy. And then I still have to remember that this Q parameter actually depends on the location. Okay, and so if I... Theta is the step function, yes. Mm-hmm. And so if I put everything together, and, you know, I have given you the formula for the volume, and okay, so there are some intermediate steps. Anyway, what you find is that Q as a function of T takes this particular form, you notice that
So is this a guess or is...
No, it's an identity. I'm just doing.
Where do you get it?
Oh, it just comes when you carefully look at the formula which I had here. For the volume, let's see, and okay, yeah. I mean, you know, you use the formula which I showed you for the volume, and I mean, yeah, this is where it comes from. I mean, you know, you put this in the exponential, and then you sort of, you know, here it's, if this is sitting in the exponential, this is where the you know, sort of the exponential weight comes from. I mean, and these things, yeah. No, I'm just doing identities. You know, at the moment, I'm not neglecting anything. So let me sort of just.
The sign when you go down.
Hmm?
You fix the sign into the exponential.
What do I have with which sign?
The minus lambda.
No, but t.
No, the t parameter goes this way, right? And so what I want to say, I mean, this is what I said already, but I mean, let me repeat. I mean, if I fix lambda, which means that I fix the volume, as I let t go to plus or minus infinity, this object will go to zero, right? I mean, so this means that...
The question was simpler.
Simpler.
You have to flip the sign, but it's already flipped because it's absolute value over there.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay.
So could you just say a bit more about how the non-crossing condition comes out? I mean, if you had nearest neighbor hopping for these fermions, then it would be obvious, but...
Yeah, that's right.
You don't...
I don't have nearest neighbor. Okay, so that's a good point, actually. Okay, I mean, I mean, okay, but what is maybe surprising is why is it still free fermion? And this is this Gesell VNO thing. I mean, the Gesell VNO tells you, and you know, that if you can represent things in terms of non-intersecting lines on a directed graph, and it so happens that this case is really in this class. Okay, you see, if, yeah, no, you're totally right. I mean, in fact, in the beginning, I was very nervous about this whole thing because it's not nearest neighbor, and so I thought, you know, maybe it will never work. But I mean, there's this sort of fortunate thing that you know, you can also allow for non-nearest neighbor, but it must fall under the Gesell VNO. Okay, and then you do the computation, you find that, you know, I mean, this is something which, you know, even independent of Gesell VNO, you can just verify directly that that's correct. Okay, so where are we? Okay, so now I want to, so this is sort of all what I want to do. I want to sort of write down the transfer matrix in all beauty. I mean, so here's the total, now this is now sort of the total, I mean, okay. I mean, this is the Boltzmann weight, if you want, so, which of course the product of transfer matrices. And so I have to distinguish between T less than 0 and T larger than 0. To the left, I have to multiply all the up jumps, up steps here, all the down steps, and then I have to remember that these things is... Okay. And then, of course, there are boundary conditions at infinity. At infinity, we have sort of just a completely filled fermacy. I mean, all the way down to minus infinity, it's occupied, and all the way, you know, from 0 up to plus infinity, it's empty. Okay. So here's the picture. I mean, so maybe this explains more than...
Remember that from computer simulation, the lines go all the way to infinity.
Yeah, that's right.
There's no cusp over there.
There is a cusp because... also from the computer simulation, you see, I mean, you really have to, you know, the cusp is, okay, you know, you cannot see the cusp here on the computer simulation. It's like this. No, it's like this. It's up here. But, you know, eventually, I mean, we just cut off our simulation, but eventually, you know, this, of course, if I fix the finite volume, it will sort of be at some finite level, right? Now, of course, if I make the volume to infinity, you're totally right. I mean, this actually diverges. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let me sort of show you again the picture. I mean, so this is what your transfer matrix does for you. I start all the way down here with the completely filled fermacy. Okay, and so now I continue. Now, as I continue inwards, I mean, this Q of T starts rising, and so now suddenly I can make some jumps. I mean, so here are the jumps. Okay, and of course the corresponding holes. I mean, under this transformation, you sort of lose this particle hole symmetry, but in any case, I mean, you know, there are holes. Okay, so now here I come to the middle, this is sort of where I have the maximum, and then things sort of are basically time reflected go the same way. So here you have a disordered region, as you see already in the computer results. Here you have all zeros, so this is ordered. And so this is one facet, that's the second facet, and this is the third facet in my Ising model, right? And, what we are interested in, as you can see, is the facet edge, so which is just exactly the last line. That's really what we would like to know. I mean, so in this you have to extract out of this transfer matrix business, okay? Okay, so the real work starts from this formula, okay, which I'm not going to tell you. I just want to tell you what the results are. I have to do a little bit, okay? So now I'm sort of telling you what we get from the asymptotic analysis. So here is my, so here's sort of the facet, I mean, which is a trivial facet. I mean, the height is sort of bending up this way. Now we look at a little box. Near the macroscopic location of the facet, the box is lambda to the minus 1/3 in this direction, lambda to the minus 2/3 in the other direction, counted in terms of lattice spacings, and then we have to sort of, we have to remove the curvature, you know, we have to center the box correctly, but then there will be still the curvature term, which we also have to remove, so there are lots of subtractions, and once you have done all that, I mean, then you will find that the statistics in the limit, in the scaling limit, will be a one-dimensional stochastic process, which I call here A of Y, and which by now has the name of Airy process. It's a non-Gaussian stochastic process. I mean, so you could look at the variances. I mean, you can look at the sort of differences in this deviation. Then for small y, it would go like Y absolute value, but I mean, things are long-range correlated. I mean, so if I look at the correlator, it goes like 1 over Y squared. And okay, so this is what you can.
What are the axes in the graph?
The axes in the graph are the ones which come from the original model. I mean, so. So these are okay. So let me. Yeah, I know. This is sort of one of them.
Oh, it's IMG.
Yeah, I and j. I mean, these are just the coordinates of the height function. I mean, so let me. Yeah. So I and j are these. I and j are these coordinates. Okay. And so what I'm plotting here is basically this line here. Right? Okay.
What do they call lambda I?
Well, because I have to do the continuum scaling limit.
Okay.
Right? So in terms of basic lattice units, so I rescale everything by a factor of lambda, right? And then, okay.
So that Airy process, it's the same thing as GUE tracing.
Okay, this is the next thing, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so now rather than giving you the formal, let me sort of tell you sort of an equivalent model where the same things actually appear, which sort of is maybe looks a little bit more sort of something you can grasp. Of course, if you eventually have to do the computation, eventually you have to express these objects in terms of some determinants, right? And so, but I don't want to write down these determinants. I mean, rather would like to tell you what this is in terms of random matrices. So let's first look at the single point. So, okay. So I'm looking now at the single point statistics. So I'm looking at one given value, and I'm looking at these transverse fluctuations, right? And then the assertion is that this is the largest eigenvalue of a Gaussian random matrix. And here you have the n by n emission matrices. That's the standard GUE ensemble. And what I do is I look at the largest eigenvalue. I do a proper scaling and going to infinity. And then you will discover that the distribution of the largest eigenvalue, it's just identical to the single point statistics of this Airy process. Okay. Now you look at two points, and when you look at two points, I mean, it's maybe not so surprising that you will get sort of a two matrix model. So I look at the joint statistics at the point zero and the point y. So I'm looking at you know, after doing, you know, I have done all these abstractions already, but I'm looking now at this point and maybe at a neighboring point over here. Okay. And then what you discover is that they are the same as the largest eigenvalue of a two matrix model. So I have a matrix A and matrix B, and I have a linear coupling. The coupling tells you how far the endpoints are apart. And if in the limit n going to infinity, I look at the joint distribution of the largest eigenvalue of A and the largest eigenvalue of B, this gives you the joint distribution of the two-point statistics of this facet edge at point location y and at location zero.
Okay. Did you understand correctly the logic to bring the random matrix theorem is just that they give you the same result?
It's the same, same universality class. I think that's the whole logic. I mean, of course, I mean, here it looks accidental, but when once you lift this random matrices sort of to Dyson-Brownian motion, then you see that there's a deep reason why it has to be the same, right?
It's the same stochastic process.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then there are differential equations which you can work out for these joint probability distributions. I mean, this was done by Tracy and Widom. Well, Tracy and Widom did, of course, the one for the. I mean, that's why it's called according by their name. They work out this distribution, but then, you know, once we told them about our results, of course, they were curious whether also quantities in the two matrix model edge statistics would be expressed in terms of differential equations, and indeed they do. I mean, the trouble is that you know, here you still get, for the single point statistic, you still get Pain-Levé, but here you get partial differential equations, which are rather difficult to handle, and sort of a lot of information, I mean, the information which you extract from these partial differential equations are not so substantial, I would say. I mean, there's a little bit of information, but you know, they're just, I mean, these partial differential equations by themselves are very difficult, and so. But they are still useful to have them. I mean, I mean, of course, for the Tracy-Widom distribution, I mean, for the single point statistics, it's extremely nice to have just the ordinary differential equation which you solve, and then you get sort of very easily very precise values. Okay, very good. So this keeps me sort of roughly on my time scale. So the last thing which I wanted to explain to you. Okay, so this was just plain, at the moment it was just sort of plain equilibrium statistical mechanics. I had this sort of free fermionic field. It was sort of a little bit unusual because it's sort of, you know, inhomogeneous in space, inhomogeneous in time. I wanted to look at the edge, so I had to do more work maybe than you know, what you would do for a translation invariant system, but otherwise it's sort of, you know, roughly in that class. Okay, now the last topic which I would like to explain.
So to come back to your statements about that you're solving only the simplest possible model, blah blah blah. I mean, have you checked it against reality?
Coming. Reality is coming. Yes. Okay. I left it for the last 5 minutes. So let me. It does. I mean, okay. All right. Okay. So now let me. So what I want now would like to briefly explain you that for other type of tiling models, the connection to the Gross model is much more direct. Okay. And so this will take me another few minutes, and then I can tell you about reality. Okay. So the 3D icing corner is what is called. I mean, it's obviously a tiling in Bombay. And models which are sort of somewhat more direct are so-called domino tilings. And this goes back to these gentlemen. I think they first observed this. I don't think actually in the physics literature this was
Speaker Will Levitt up in 1990 or something like that about dominoes and the crystal facets.
Oh, I see. Okay, you tell me the reference. Yeah. Okay, very good. Okay, so. Okay, yeah, it's difficult because there are sort of different communities working on this problem. Anyway, so here is what you want to do. I mean, you take now a special domain, and the domain which you pick is a square, but it's sort of orientated at 45 degrees, right? And it's important that these corners here have lengths two. I mean, so this is lengths two, this is lengths two, and then you have at your disposal these dominoes, and you're supposed to tile, which means that you have no holes or what people also call perfect matching. And of course, there will be many possibilities. And just as before, I look at the simplest case where they have equal weight. Okay, and again, you can do a sort of computer simulation. And what you discover, I'm not sure how this is. I've taken from the thesis of health code, so I'm not sure how good. Well, actually, it's not so bad, the simulation. Okay, so you can see this. So here's sort of what I mean, these are sort of the south, west, north, and east tiles. And again, you see the same phenomenon. Here you have sort of the facets. They are now, of course, geometrically somewhat different because the model is different, but the phenomenon is the same. And inside here you have your Gaussian free field. And this one will fluctuate according to the airy process. Right? Okay, so that's fine. So that's just sort of same thing in blue. And now comes the interesting numerical question. I mean, suppose you want to simulate such a picture numerically. How would you do it? Well, the first most stupid idea is you just start tiling. And of course, you know, it doesn't work. I mean, if you do tilings at home, I mean, typically you end up at a bad corner and it just doesn't make a complete matching, right? I mean, so this is not a very good idea. Now, the next thing is you say, yeah, I'm much more clever. Now, I learned a little bit about statistical mechanics. So let's just do a Monte Carlo algorithm, which sort of simulates this as a two-dimensional statistical mechanics system. That's fine also, but remember, it's a Gaussian free field. So it will be very, very slow. I mean, you know, this is not something which sort of goes very fast. I mean, you know, after all, the system is critical. I mean, so we are simulating a critical system, so we have critical slowing down, all right? So that's, of course, a nice challenge to computer people and so how to do it. And they invented something which is called the shuffling algorithm, which is a very neat idea. Of course, it doesn't work sort of in general, but at least it works for this system and some related system. And the idea is that, you know, rather than trying to immediately solve the full system, you know, first simulate the small system and then go from size n to n plus 1. So let me explain you this in a few words. I mean, first of all, I have to distinguish the tiles. I mean, you should think that there's an underlying sort of checkerboard lattice. And so some of the sides are, some of the checkers are white and the other ones are black. So these are these ones. And so this is how I can distinguish between north and south tiles and west and east tiles. Okay. And now the idea is that you increase your domain to n plus 1. I mean, so what you do is... this is the wrong one. This is maybe, you know, domain n equal 1. And then you just increase it by one unit, okay? So this means that now I have just one corner. So I add these four sides. So this would be n equal to 2. And then you just keep going, right?
So n is what then?
Well, n is sort of this. I mean, this is sort of n here. I mean, okay. So here n would be equal to 2, and here n is equal to 1. Okay. All right. Now you start tiling this one, which is of course easy. I mean, there are only two possibilities. Okay, and then you increase by one unit, and then you do this shuffling step. The shuffling step means that. Okay, let me show you this for this one. Okay, so here I have already sort of, for my first decision, I have already these two tiles, okay? And the shuffling step means that whenever I see a west tile, I move it to the west. Whenever I, so this is a west tile, this is an east tile. Okay, so whenever I see a west tile, I move it to the west. Whenever I see an east tile, I move it to the east. And then what you find in the next step, of course, is that you have sort of a domain which you can divide into squares. I mean, this is already fixed. This is already fixed. You have these two squares, and here you make a random choice. I mean, you either put it this way or the other way. Okay. And then you just keep going, and then if you make the system larger, you see that there's also possibility that I have somewhere an east tile over here and the west tile over here. Now this wants to move this way and this wants to move this way. Then now you simply declare that they annihilate each other. But they only move one step. I mean, you know, you do one step and then you do not continue. Anyway, and so all the holes which you have created, you just fill randomly. Okay, and then you can think of what is the dynamics which is induced on the facet edge. I mean, so let's take the edge of the south zone. So this is now I'm giving you the algorithm for this lower line here. Okay, well, and what you find is a very simple algorithm. So you see that at the minima and the maxima of this line, you must have an even number of steps. When you increase or when you decrease, you must have an odd number of steps. So this is sort of what I mean. It's only those configurations of facet edges which you can actually which can occur. And the updating. So below here you have all south tiles. I mean, so they're all tiled like this, right? I mean, so this is a south tile. Now the updating simply means that I fill in the local minima randomly. I mean, so I do this with, you know, probability 1/2, this one with probability 1/2. And then, of course, if I, on the odd ones, I have something which is somewhat longer, and if such a square would fit, I mean, such a tile would fit, I'd also put it there, okay? And so once you have this picture, the only thing which you have to still to verify is that when you go to, you have to compute for this model the gross velocity as a function of the tilt. You have to take the second derivative, and you discover that the second derivative is negative. That tells you that the coupling constant of the KPC equation is different from zero, and therefore this must be in the KPC universality class. Okay? So for this model, you have sort of this direct matching between the two. Okay, now I'm finished, and let me give you an outlook. Okay, so first of all, there's, I guess, what was mentioned already, you know, question of universality. So we developed the scaling theory, which you can sort of look up in our paper, where we sort of identify all sort of the non-universal quantities and sort of discuss under what condition we think, I mean, this theory actually should be applicable, okay? Then you might think, well, maybe one can do sort of more microscopic models. I mean, so there are more tiling models. So there's one famous work here by Kenyon Okunkov and Sheffield, which sort of builds on work of Castellane. And one of the most sort of, from a statistical mechanics point of view, the most interesting thing is that now you get also sort of like in this language a 1-1-1 facet, which has non-trivial excitation. You see, our facets have been completely trivial; they're just completely flat. Okay. And now, of course, I mean, I really would like to do this case, but I mean, somehow I couldn't convince my collaborators to really work on this. I mean, you know, it's I find it interesting because also the notion of a facet edge is, of course, no longer really microscopically defined. You know, there might be, I mean, also the facet edge, you know, might be broken, and so how do you exactly identify the facet edge? I mean, it's not okay. Anyway, so this is one thing which I still think would be nice to have. I mean, because it would give sort of a little bit more convincing sort of evidence that you know, even if the facet is not absolutely perfect, I mean, you know, this kind of sort of asymptotic scaling is correct. You see, all the lattice things, maybe I didn't emphasize so much. I mean, you know, under the scaling, I mean, the facet edge from its neighboring is very, very far apart. It's, you know, in our units, it's sort of R to the 1/3 lattice spacing apart. And so all the lattice details, I mean, also these interactions which you might void, the kink interaction, all these kind of things, for the facet edge, I mean, they shouldn't make much difference because they are so far apart. You see, if I look in the bulk, of course, it's very different because they are close and then they will see all this microscopic interaction. But here, also the lattice, I mean, should make any difference because, you know, they are huge distances apart and so they're basically isolated. Only once in a while they have this contact interaction which sort of produces these statistics. So I don't think it will make much of a difference. Okay. The next thing is that something which sort of did not happen too often in my life, I must say. I was very pleased that experimentalists sort of picked up on this issue, and there's sort of this group in Maryland, I mean, who know how to produce such systems. And I mean, they found this very interesting, and they said, okay, let's check whether this theory is actually correct. And the trouble is that first they did something which is sort of the trivial thing. I mean, you really study the R dependencies. In their letter, I mean, you can see some plots of the R dependence. It's not very good. I mean, the system size is small and you don't really see so much. I mean, they can, I guess, with reasonably confidence say it cannot be just a random walk. I mean, this is something which they definitely would claim. But, you know, to get out this scaling exponent, I mean, the two-thirds or the one-third scaling exponent, I mean, this is sort of, I mean, it's not very convincing. Unless you would know already what the result is, you would not guess, okay? So what they said, I mean, look, I mean, it's much easier experimentally to actually measure the fluctuations at one given point of the facet in time. So they are sitting at the fixed location, and then they see the facet fluctuating in time, in physical time, transversely, okay? Now it's this signal, and when you look at the signal, I mean, you see already a huge difference, I mean, whether it's actually sort of just an isolated step, which would be a random walk, or whether it's a facet edge, which has sort of this airy type process fluctuations. So what they measure experimentally is they just measure sort of the roughness of mean square displacement of these fluctuations. I mean, they just record the time signal, and out of this they get this variance. And then there's the dynamical theory, which was devised by Pimpinelli, and which uses as a static input our exponent, you know, the KPC exponent, for that purpose. And out of this they get a power law behavior, which is 2 over 11. And it's this power law which is experimentally verified with, I mean, actually quite, I mean, sort of on scale of these experiments, I mean, with a rather good precision. So in a somewhat indirect way, I mean, you would say that, you know, through this measurement, I mean, actually this is reasonably confirmed. Thank you very much.
Dynamics that they choose is just some standard
Langevin dynamics, but then you have to, you see, they have to make some assumptions on how, how does the facet actually move? And, you know, it sort of moves actually via surface diffusion. I mean, so you must put in this conservation law into your edge dynamics. It's not just simple sort of, it's not just global dynamics. You have to do a little bit more, yeah. And that's also why they get these funny exponents, yeah. So yeah, but that's basically what they formulate directly a continuum theory, which sort of uses the correct conservation laws, which they believe, since they know their system very well, they believe that that's sort of quite okay, and then they have to use this as an input. And
there is this relationship. There is this work by Okunko that you, for example, mentioned.
Okay, so there are two works by Okunko. I mean, so let me.
How does it relate? Just maybe in just 2 minutes. What is the connection?
Okay, so of course Okunko has done many things. So I'm not able to sort of, you know, sort of give sort of a short summary of what he has done. But in connection to what I was talking about, there are two things which are related. One of them is that Okunko and Reshetyakin observed, you know, coming from a somewhat rather different perspective, but observed that this corner growth model has this free fermion type character in our language. Okay, so this was one thing. But they came, you know, they sort of come from these Schur processes, and I mean, there's sort of more mathematics behind it than what I was able to explain. But so this is one of their work. And the other one, which is cited very often, is sort of this one of Kenyon, Okunkov, and Sheffield. And what they do is they use sort of I mean, there they think in terms of tilings, but the tilings are on more complicated lattices, and they are also on you can have also weights which are periodic. So maybe the lattice is sort of regular, but then the weights have sort of like, you know, period 2 or period 3. I mean, depending on what lattice it will be. Now for this thing, They sort of using, I mean, based on ideas of Kastelein, but, you know, very much sort of, you know, enhanced, they were able to, what is published, I mean, you can look this up in whatever Advances of Mathematics, I guess, I mean, but they were able to compute is the shape function. Okay, so it's just determine the equilibrium shape. I mean, they computed the surface free energy. And the surprising thing is that the functions which appear there seem to have sort of, you know, some interesting connections which functions in other sort of geometry, I mean, you know, differential geometry and algebraic differential geometry. I mean, there are also, in fact, I mean, I noticed that some of the string people actually use our papers to illustrate some of the models in this area, right? I mean, so the point is that you know, they connect it to other things. This is why, you know, their work is so often cited, okay?
And can I think of this connection as originating through the connection with random matrix theory?
No. They were, I mean, at least in this work, they were straightly thinking about tilings.
Okay.
Just they were thinking about tilings, yes.
There is a work also by Nekrasov, right, at DHS, which actually related to this
corner. Very good. You tell me. I actually not completely aware of that. Okay.
So.
Okay. I put already a piece of.
Late, so
yeah. Okay. Sorry.
So let's have a break in 5 minutes.
I have to. No, it's just one.